So, Elaine, what was your journey to getting this novel, The Light Between Us, published?
It was somewhat arduous. So I did try a lot of agents, probably over 50, between 50 to 70.
Wow.
I was rejected by all of them.
Wow.
To be honest, to be very, very honest, with all the rejections, I began to lose faith myself. I thought maybe something in my writing that wasn't that great. It was longlisted for the inaugural Cheshire Novel Prize. So I knew it was good. But when the rejections came, none of them gave a specific reason, like, you know, this character isn't working, or the writing is, you know, you need to fix that here or do that there. All of it was a step aside. When I submitted it to Neemtree, they were so excited. This publisher was the first independent, small, traditional publisher I tried. They accepted it within 24 hours. They gave me the acceptance. So I knew then it wasn't my writing or the way that story unfolded. For whatever reason, it just maybe was not at the right time, at the right place for agents to take it on. That's all it is.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to the Asian Book Chef, where we explore Southeast Asia's literary landscape. If you are a discerning reader, perhaps even an aspiring writer, you are in exactly the right place. We interview acclaimed writers and key industry figures to explore Southeast Asia's literature. And we take a deep dive into its narrative elements, characters, themes, and emerging trends. We explore what works and why. Can a particular book be translated into another medium, say a movie, a documentary? What literary trends are emerging in our region? Is it all romance, or are non-fiction graphic novels on the rise? We believe in-depth conversations like this will enhance Southeast Asia's English literary scene. The Asian Bookshelf is produced and co-hosted by acclaimed writers T.A. Morton, John Grisham, and presenter me, Devika Misra. We're all Singapore-based, but of Irish, Australian, and Indian heritage, and bring our own unique insights and experiences to Southeast Asia's stories. Please join us on the Asian Bookshelf, home to words and voices from Asia today. In this episode, episode 2 of the Asian Bookshelf, we will discuss The Light Between Us by Elaine Chu. Our focus is the power of images, photographs across time and space. The Light Between Us is Elaine's debut novel and is published by Neemtree Press. I'm your podcast host, Devika Misra.
And I'm John Gresham.
And today, we're super lucky. We're fortunate enough to have Elaine right here with us in the studio.
A flash of lightning strobes across the clerestory of the Singapore Centre of Photography. The flare in the cloistered gallery reveals a portrait of a woman. She is decked out in ceremonial robes, embroidered with peonies and phoenixes. Her feet, encased in beaded slippers, rest on a pouf. Her hands lie on the arms of a Chinese straight-backed chair, each finger distinctly displayed. There are no shadows on her face. Her visage is grim and stern, no semblance of a smile, as befitting an ancestor portrait. Ear-splitting thunder follows, as if the sky is being rent asunder.
Photography back then in the 1920s and 30s, it was a very cumbersome, scientific, slow, complex, chemical and mechanical process. And the people that were having their photos taken were quite privileged. They could afford to buy these photos and keep them. You know, they were quite a special thing to have, a photo. Whereas now, it's ubiquitous. Like, social media has devalued the individual photo. Like, I can take a photo of you exactly now, and it's just one of, you know, hundreds of thousands of millions of being taken right at this moment. So do you want to comment about that difference in the context of your novel?
I was just very taken with the idea of how you actually had to go through this laborious process of having something on a glass negative, and then you develop that in a dark room. You had to make sure the light conditions were fine. And at that point in time, actually, when there wasn't electricity, you needed a pinhole at the top. So your dark room had to be absolutely at the top of the shop house so that you could get enough light to develop your photograph. And I also remember taking quite some time to investigate, how am I going to get this quantum entanglement mechanism happening, you know, when she's able to do this digital thing, which you can imagine probably already is quite mystical, because actually a photograph, when it's loaded onto the digital format, is actually just a sequence of numbers. So I needed to investigate into, like, what components, materials make up glass negatives, you know, what are some of the chemicals involved. So that whole thing was actually, took me some time to try and understand it. But then finally, in the end, I did find something. I was very excited. Yeah.
So I was going to say, I see the power of the letter, of course, in your book. But to me, reading the whole book, it was very much an ode to the photograph. Tell us about that. Tell us what photographs, real photographs, inspired you and the magic of the photograph.
Yeah, I do love the whole sort of contextual as well as the theory of the photograph. Susan Sontag actually said something along the lines of life is a movie, but death is a photograph. So I was very intrigued by this point that, in fact, whenever we're actually holding a photograph, we're actually holding a piece of the past, because that moment is gone. And those people in it, when they were that self, that's gone as well. So you're always constantly actually reinserting the past into your present when you're actually looking at photographs. And also what's so interesting to me about photographs is that it's contained in a frame, isn't it? Well, that framed moment, it's frozen, that moment. But when you think about it, it tells you very little. You think you know everything from just looking at that photograph. Oh, you were there at this point in time. You know, you did this, you ate this. But actually, what else does it tell you beyond that? And we refashion ourselves for the camera all the time. We project. It's a space of fantasy and desire. We want to look as if we're doing something. We're better than we are. You know, look. By showing numerous photographs of everywhere that we've gone to and everything we've eaten that's so beautiful it should be photographed, we give the impression we're really affluent. Look at my life, how amazing it is, right? But is it really the truth?
Yeah, so that does come out, Elaine, very much. That is the photograph a fact or an illusion? So, Elaine, I bet as a visual writer, I can see that you're really a visual person. I bet you've given this some thought. Can this book be made into a movie? Who would play Charlie? Who would play Tian Wei? Tell us.
Oh, that's so hard to choose from. My goodness. If I had my way, because Tian Wei, there are four main characters. You know, the two main leads, Tian Wei and Charlie, and two second leads, as you do in K-drama style. And the two second leads are Sebastian and Aiko, who's Japanese. So for Aiko, and I think she has to be Japanese, I think, but preferably a Japanese actress who's actually quite comfortable with Nanyang. You know, Aiko actually in the book speaks Malay fluently. Sebastian, I actually hinted, it's really hot Taiwanese actor Bruce Hung. For Tian Wei, Tian Wei actually has very middling looks. So he's actually not like your handsomest guy out there. And he's not particularly tall either. I suppose you could do anything you want, really, in a TV series, can't you? So I would choose probably... You know, actually, do you know the MediaCorp drama Little Nyonya? There's the actor in there was, I can't remember his name, Dai something, Dai Xiangyu, actually, Dai Xiangyu. And so I think he would have been perfect for Tian Wei.
Your book is built on a key relationship across time and space between Charlie in 2019, who's an art curator, and Tian Wei, who's a photographer from the 19... 10s, 20s and 30s. So my question is, what attracts each of your main characters to the other, especially in the context that they're not actually physically together very much? Or, you know, well, that, I don't want to do any spoilers on that particular aspect of it, but they're largely disembodied. Their relationship is largely by correspondence of a certain kind that you find out when you read it. So what attracts each of your main characters, Charlie
to
Chen Wei?
I would say that both of them are misfits.
Yeah.
You know, Charlie is a photography archivist, and she gets roped into doing, you know, curation for photography exhibitions, which is quite a feather in her cap for her. But if you think about what an archivist does, and I actually did a little bit of this at the Institute of Contemporary Arts, you spend a lot of time looking at photographs by yourself, and really all you're interfacing with is, you know, a screen, you know, and the archives. So really, literally, she spends quite a lot of time just in her own head. And then Tian Wei is also a misfit because he, you know, is a transplant to these shores. He's from Shanghai. He grew up as a street urchin. He almost lost his life. But he has this aspiration to want to become a wenren, a literati, or an educated person at the very least. I wanted them to kind of be themselves because I think letters is one of those places. I guess it's quite a, it's somewhat old-fashioned. We don't write letters anymore, do we? But when you are writing a letter to somebody and you know that you won't be able to hear back from them for some time, there's a tendency to probably to be yourself because it's almost like you're writing to yourself, really. And you do go on a bit, you know, whereas nowadays we're all writing only texts and, you know, it's short, but it's a different mode of communication. So I really wanted to kind of go back into that epistolary format of communicating with each other. And that sometimes, you know, in the pandemic, it was really strange. It was really interesting because a lot of people were dating despite the fact that it was a pandemic and they couldn't meet. Mm-hmm. And what you had then was just text, wasn't it? It was just the written letter.
And Zoom and FaceTime and Skype, people were, you know, that's where I guess Zoom and FaceTime really came into their own as a way of connecting.
Very true.
And both for business and for family and entertainment.
Yeah, but it's still disembodied.
Yeah.
It's still a disembodied. You're not actually physically interacting in the same space-time. So I think that for me was a sort of parallel that I was thinking about. How successful, I mean, technology obviously mediates a lot of these kind of interactions. But I wanted to show that even though disembodied, you're able to have a meeting of the minds.
So you think people can fall in love merely by sending letters to each other nowadays?
Nowadays, I don't know. I don't know. Nowadays might be hard, yeah. But in the 1920s and 1930s, it was exactly how they fell in love.
Yeah,
you know, you never got to meet. In fact, straight Chinese women, young women, were so chaperoned that a lot of times marriages were arranged for them. So there was no possibility of meeting who you were going to marry. You might get a glimpse through a photograph.
I was wondering why you didn't change the dialogue styles. Was that a conscious decision?
What do you mean that I didn't change the dialogue style?
I meant that, you know, Charlie speaks like we would speak in 2019. Yes. And he speaks in a totally different way. I mean, so you would think that when she wrote to him, she would
try to become more like him.
Change her language, soften her language. She makes reference to the cloud and he thinks it's something in the sky.
I think language is a timestamp of evolution. So one of the things that bother me actually about historical novels, or not even necessarily historical novels, but any sort of like time traveling novel that has two disparate timelines, is if the two periods are actually too similar. So where did history go then? We have conflated, we have flattened the whole thing. And we do not show that, you know, language actually evolves. So I really wanted to make sure we capture that sense of history. Because if you, that's actually, it brings to mind a very famous book. I don't know if you've read it, but we all know The Great Gatsby, right? We're all big readers here. Sarah Churchwell actually wrote a nonfiction book, examining all the events that had inspired F. Scott Fitzgerald to write The Great Gatsby. And it's really fascinating because when you look at how she looks at 1920s slang, they describe things a really, really, you know, in a very different style, in a very different way. They had like 40, like more than 40 words for like how you say getting drunk, you know, getting drunk, like it could be like tanked. And there was one that I really loved, you know, what was it? To have the screaming memes. We it's not something we would say today, would it? But don't you think that's just so funny? For me, immediately I kind of saw the potential for humor. You know, we could mine that linguistic humor when you've got disparate timelines, as well as stay faithful to the historic periods.
I have seen it being described as historical romance-y, where crazy rich Asians meets the time traveler's wife. And I've heard other people say, oh yeah, remember the movie? Keanu Reeves, Sandra Bullock, The Lake House. So I wonder if there's an attempt by people in general, a natural tendency to constantly try and peg local literature, Southeast Asian literature, to better known, established Western reference points. What do you think?
I confess that when I was applying, when I was actually sending the manuscript to agents, I did use Time Traveler's Wife. You know, they have this formula that they want you to do, Time Traveler's Wife times something else, you know. I did not use Crazy Rich Asians.
Okay,
although
good to know.
There's a very rich family dynamic within the book that's a little bit toxic. I did not use that. The Lake House, I have not heard, but I do know what that movie is about, and I can see the resemblance. But your bigger question, the more political one, is actually a very good question, because, yes, when books go out on the global stage, this book will also be out in the United States in September, and it's an English reading public, there is a tendency to use Western reference points because that's what they know. There's also, because the book is so heavily into Singapore history, sometimes you get readers who say, you know, I don't know any Singapore history. I don't know this particular segment of history. Why should I be interested? So it's a marketing speak thing that we do. It's jingoism. So that's, you know, you sort of need it, don't you? You need to sell books. But the more important thing that I'm going to actually just kind of plug right now is that two things that are really important for me to achieve in this novel. One was that it's, for me, at the heart of it, a decolonizing novel. All the people on it that take center stage are Straits Chinese and Sinca Chinese. I'm talking really about the Chinese diaspora in Singapore in the 1920s and 1930s. And secondly, the other thing that was important for me also was that a lot of books coming out of our region that are being picked up internationally always focus on World War II, as if the only thing interesting coming out of our region is the war, to the point that some readers overseas are actually accusing us of trauma porn, you know. So I think what's really what I really wanted to achieve, the World War II is featured in the book, but it's featured towards the end of the book. What I really wanted to throw light on is the fact that history doesn't happen in like a singular event. You know, the lead up to war was actually happening in Singapore in the 1920s and 1930s. There was a huge political ferment re-Sinicization, of also, you know, all the Hui Guans, the proliferation of reading clubs. The local Sun Yat-sen made 9 visits here. So, you know, a lot of the local Kuomintang chapters were also growing at that time. This was a huge time of political ferment. As well, the women's emancipation movement was actually led by the leadership of the Straits Chinese. So I wanted to focus on all that. That's so exciting. So we that history needs to be told. You know, it needs to be told not just for us, it's for the whole world. Why should feminism always be Western feminism? Global feminisms are so interesting. We don't know enough about it on the global stage. Yeah. So I wanted to do that. Those two movements form the backdrop of the novel.
So Elaine, what was your journey to getting this novel, The Light Between Us, published?
It was somewhat arduous because I was going, it being a debut novel, it does make sense to go the agent route. And I had already moved to London at that time. So it made sense to do that. So I did try a lot of agents, probably over 50, between 50 to 70.
Wow.
I was rejected by all of them.
Wow.
This publisher was the first independent, small, traditional publisher I tried. They accepted it within 24 hours.
That's great.
To be very, very honest, with all the rejections, I began to lose faith myself. I thought maybe something in my writing that wasn't that great.
Because it was over a number of years, presumably, and you went through batches.
It was all in 1 year. Okay. All in 1 year. I had finished editing it. I knew it was ready. I knew that I wasn't going to change too much more, so it was time to just send it out and try my luck. And it was longlisted for the inaugural Cheshire Novel Prize, so I knew it was good. But when the rejections came, none of them gave a specific reason, like this character isn't working, or the writing is you need to fix that here or do that there. All of it was a step aside, which in agent speak means they don't feel confident taking it on as a project. This story deserves to be told on the global stage for the reasons that I outlined. This history is not niche. It's got to do with global feminism, and people are going to be interested. And when I submitted it to Neem Tree, they were so excited. Within 24 hours, they gave me the acceptance. So I knew then it wasn't my writing or the way that story unfolded. It was, for whatever reason, it just maybe was not at the right time, at the right place for agents to take it on. That's all it is.
Yeah.
This is, of course, a fantasy romance. It seems for you, on the one hand, it's very much grounded in Elaine Chu, right? When we talk about the immigrant experience, the Sinke, the Chinese coming across, making a new life in Southeast Asia, in the Strait settlements. On the other hand, without giving too much away, it's completely a flight of fantasy. I don't want to say anything more about spirits or anything, but you see, I've given it away there. But what made you do this? I mean, it's such an ambitious novel. On the one hand, there's this painstaking research into history. The Strait settlements, the war, pre-war, as we talked about. On the other hand, it's just totally let my imagination fly. What made you do this for your debut novel?
That's a very good question. I think that I wanted to make sure that history could still speak to us today. And so I wanted to make sure that in some ways it has that dual timeline. But how do I connect them, That's really where the fantasy comes in. You need a mechanism to connect them. And, time-traveling romance is a huge draw. And also speculative fiction from our region is actually such a major key strength for our regional literature. I really wanted to be part of that. It's just, to me, really exciting. And to be honest, it's not actually a completely new thing for me, it's fantasy. It's just the thing I managed to get published, I tried a lot of different, but sometimes you get rejected, that's the nature of the game, So for me, I also think that because of all that, there's a huge market out there as well. And lo and behold, I did not know this actually when I was writing it, but romanticism is the code word for literature this coming year.
Wow. Now that is something for us all to take away. Elaine, congratulations on The Light Between Us. Thank you, Elaine. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
We hope that you have enjoyed this episode of The Asian Bookshelf and have a deeper understanding of Elaine Chu's The Light Between Us. We trust that this conversation has given you as much pleasure as it's given us to produce. Of course, our opinions, our interpretations are not the only valid ones. We'd love to hear from you at contact@theasianbookshelf or in the show notes below. And please follow, please subscribe to The Asian Bookshelf on your favorite podcast platforms. You can find us on X, formerly Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. And do join us for our next insightful conversation. Coming up, we're going to discuss the viability and potential of the independent bookstore in today's context. My co-host, authors T.A. Morton and John Grisham, will be sitting down with Alex Chua, the owner of Singapore's Book Bar, to discuss its role in our community. Many thanks for joining us on The Asian Bookshelf, home to words and voices in Asia today.